Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of Inside Scoop Live, one of many services presented to you by Reader Views. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Hello, and thank you for tuning in. Today, I'm chatting with Albert Bell about his latest book, Perfect Game, Imperfect Lives, a memoir celebrating the 50th anniversary of Don Larson's Perfect Game. But before we delve into his book, I'd like to share a little information about Albert. He has taught at Hope College in Holland, Michigan since 1978. His wife is a psychologist, and they have four adult children and an adorable grandson. In addition to a number of articles, stories, and such nonfiction books as Exploring the New Testament World, Bell has published a mystery novel, Killer Again, I love the title, which is set against the backdrop of an archaeological excavation in Italy, and he has written a children's historical mystery, The Case of the Lonely Grave, that connects contemporary children with the Underground Railroad and the Civil War era. Both of these won him the Author's Choice Prize in 2000. He's also the author of a mystery set in ancient Rome, All Roads Lead to Murder, published by High Country Publishers in 2002, and intended as the first in the series. The Midwest Book Review has called this one of the best antiquarian murder mysteries penned to date. And then he wrote a contemporary mystery set in Grand Rapids and titled Death Goes Dutch, published by Claystone Books in March of 2006 and dubbed a gem by Round Table Reviews. Now about Perfect Game, Imperfect Lives, a memoir celebrating the 50th anniversary of Don Larson's Perfect Game. Albert, welcome.
Thank you, Gail.
It's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, now with this setup, tell us what's so unique and important about a perfect game.
A perfect game in baseball means that 27 batters come to the plate and 27 guys make outs. No hits, no walks, no errors. Nobody gets to first base.
He just throws an absolutely perfect ball right across the center plate, huh?
Well, people can hit it, but they still, fly balls or whatever kind of out. It just means nobody is safe at first base.
Right, gotcha. Now, it's my understanding that in addition to baseball, the only other sport where you can achieve perfection is bowling.
Yeah, the 300 game in bowling. I went bowling Saturday night for the first time in a long time, took my grandson and family.
How'd you do?
Very poorly.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But, if you get a strike in every frame, you end up with a 300 game, a perfect game. But those are the only two sports in basketball or football or golf. There's no such thing as if you do this, you have a perfect performance.
Right, exactly. Oh. Well, now, Don Larson was a relative unknown in 1956 during that World Series. And how is it that that someone like Don Larson, a relative unknown in the midst of so many great pitchers, could come anywhere near achieving perfection when the others couldn't get close to it?
Well, there were some great pitchers in those days, Whitey Ford and Robin Roberts and a number of others. The fellow who pitched for the Dodgers against Larson that day, Sal Magley, had actually pitched a no-hitter about 2 weeks before that, so there were all kinds of guys around who were quite capable of doing it. But Larson was an outstanding athlete. Casey Stengel said that he could be one of the great pitchers of his day anytime he put his mind to it. But Larson admits himself in his own writings that he was a playboy. He did not take things seriously and just never developed the talent that he had. But that one day, it seemed like everything clicked. His pitches were right where they needed to be, and his teammates made a couple of spectacular plays behind him. He had actually come close to pitching a no-hitter once before. He had gotten into the ninth inning with a no-hitter. So it was not that he could not do it. It just was everything, came together that day, and there it was.
Well, and it sounds like a lot of what came together was his own mindset. Was he conscious of having made a decision to give it his best?
Well, I think he was trying to show, particularly after game two of the series that year, he had gotten pelted around pretty good. He gave up six runs in two innings in game two. And so I think he was determined to show that he could come back and do better than that. But then, like I say, just the way people played behind him and the way things fell in.
Everyone played as a part of a team rather than as an individual.
Yeah. He had also modified his delivery a little bit toward the end of the 56 season. He thought opposing teams were able to tell what he was going to throw. And so he had shortened his windup, and that seemed to affect opposing batters.
Hmm.
Ted Williams said it threw his timing off.
And,
so, you know, this was only the second time the Dodgers had seen him, and I think they just weren't accustomed to that new windup that he was using.
How old was Don Larson at that time?
He was 27.
Okay, he's just a kid.
Well, he'd been in the majors for about 4 years. This was the best season that he had. He won 10 games the next year in 57, but after that he tailed off. And he stayed in the majors till about 1967, but his final record was 81 wins and 91 losses. So, you know, he never achieved the potential that a lot of people felt like he had.
Hmm. That's too bad. Well, now, there are a lot of things that were going on in the mid-50s. In the first place, baseball was the sport. It was the greatest thing going, wasn't it?
Yeah, Sports Illustrated in one issue that year said not even sex will ever replace baseball.
Right.
And the NFL really had not become a major factor at that point. The NBA was still playing in places like Fort Wayne and Syracuse. So, yeah, those leagues, those sports, just did not have the popular attention or the attention of the press. The way that baseball did.
No, not at that time. And things have changed fairly radically in the ensuing 50 years, haven't they?
Yeah, I think because of the quality of the players that we've seen in basketball and football, you know, they're bigger, they're faster. Bill Russell became a pro basketball player in 56. Will Chamberlain was in college, so he would come along a couple of years later. And once those two guys came into the NBA, they attracted a lot of attention and really changed the whole sport.
Right, right. Well, not only at that time was baseball the greatest thing going, but the 50s era itself was considered a golden age. What was it about that cast that kind of spell, especially on a decade that was really as tumultuous as any before and since?
For those who lived through it, and I did, I was 11 years old in 1956, you looked at the papers every day and there were civil rights riots and things going on. And,
right.
The Russians, the Soviets were threatening us with nuclear holocaust, it seemed like every day. And yet,
threats within and without, huh?
Yeah, exactly. We didn't know whether we were going to be torn apart or crushed from outside.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I think for people of that time, and as we look back on it, there's something the same thing. We had come through the Depression, the Second World War. We felt like we were really on top of things. We were achieving things. The
economy
highway,
was doing well.
Yeah, the economy was doing well. Interstate highway system was being built. Americans felt like they were really on top. They were where they ought to be. And as we look back, I think there's kind of a yearning for that sense of security that we don't have anymore.
Yeah, it's almost like deja vu all over again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, and of course, also at that time, we were being molded, so to speak, or at least attempts were being made to mold us by programs such as Ozzie and Harriet and serenades by Lawrence Welk and his group. And you're right, the Cold War and the Civil Rights Movements and Elvis Presley.
Yeah, Elvis was, 56 was his big year. He was nationally was almost unknown in January. By the end of the year, he had three gold records. Love Me Tender, the movie, came out in November. He'd been on the Ed Sullivan Show a couple of times. So it was really, he just skyrocketed during that year.
Wow.
But there were also, you know, there were shows like Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver during the late 50s,
mm-hmm.
All of which really showed a sort of an ideal family with the working, know-it-all father, all-knowing father, I should say.
All know, that's right.
and the mother.
And the stay-at-home mom.
Yeah, who cooked and cleaned in her pearls and high heels.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're all of us girls growing up trying to figure out, okay, how do we do that?
Yeah. And the kids got into minor little scrapes, but there was never, you weren't worried about whether your girlfriend was pregnant or something like that.
No, you weren't worried about gang violence. You weren't worried about kids taking guns into schools.
No, none of that.
So it was a very different era. Mm-hmm. And there you were, an 11-year-old boy, an avid New York Yankees fan, uprooted from your close-knit family in South Carolina and transplanted to Cincinnati.
Yeah, my dad got a job in Cincinnati, so we moved up there. Unfortunately, after the school year started, so I was the new kid.
Oh, boy.
Everybody knows how bad it is to be the new kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I met another boy. He had moved in August, just before school started.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also sort of on the fringe. He hadn't made any friends. He came from Brooklyn. I call him Mitch in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And Mitch was an avid Dodger fan. Of course, I was the Yankee fan.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing was we were baseball fans.
And you lived it, breathed it. It was everything about your whole being was about baseball.
Yeah, we played it every chance we got. We collected baseball cards. He and I met collecting baseball cards.
Mm-hmm.
And since we were in a city with a pro team, we ended up getting autographs from some of those guys too.
Wow. So you were able to go to some of those games, is this right?
Yes, I was. Not in 56. The season was pretty much over when I got there, but the next summer I did get to see some games.
Well, and so there you were, 11, new to the community, a new friend, and on Monday, October the 8th, you and your buddy Mitch decide to skip school after lunch and go watch that fifth game of the World Series.
Yeah, it was not unusual for people to take off from work or skip school or something to watch the series. Of course, they showed the game. You know, the games were played in the daytime then.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I had read in the papers about how important Game 5 was going to be. The series was tied 2-2, and the papers were pretty much saying, you know, whoever won Game 5 was going to win the series. And so both his parents worked, and we just decided, you know, we could do this. We could leave school at lunch, and there was a bus that ran near the school where we went, and we could get back home. And we made it. We got there just about as they were throwing out the first pitch or the first inning.
Wow. Now, where were you? Now, your father was working. Where was your mother? Was she home?
She was at
home. You were in school.
That's why we couldn't go to my house. And Mitch also had a color TV, and I was thrilled about that. But as it turned out, the series was broadcast in black and white.
So. Oh, gee.
Yeah, I got cheated on that.
Well, but I bet it didn't detract at all from the experience, did it?
No. We really couldn't believe what was happening. Of course, nobody could. I mean, there had been only 15 perfect games in the history of baseball, and this was, I think there had only been 8 or 9 at that time.
Wow.
And this was the first one in World Series history. All the rest of them were in the regular season.
And there hasn't been another one in World Series history, has there?
That's right.
Wow, one and only. Mm-hmm. Well, now, Albert, just a little bit about what was going on for you. I mean, this book is a memoir, and it also celebrates the 50th anniversary of Don Larsen's perfect game. But you were just 11 years old. Tell us a little bit about what it was like as an 11-year-old. There you were beginning to go through puberty, and your family has moved. Tell us what it was like moving from a small town in South Carolina to Cincinnati.
Well, I really felt uprooted. I had grown up with, there were 14 grandchildren in my family, so anytime we went to my grandparents' house, there was always somebody around. And
They were all there, huh?
Yeah, family was very important.
You had your own baseball team right there in your family.
So, yeah, with my cousins and a few kids from the neighborhood there, we could always play. And my grandparents had a huge open lot next to their house that they owned, so that was great, too.
Perfect.
Yeah,
perfect.
Moving to Cincinnati, and I really did feel like I was losing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I mean, anybody knows what it's like going through puberty. You don't know from day to day what your body's going to be doing. Or
right.
And in those days, you didn't talk about it all that much. I mean, I don't blame my parents, but I didn't get a whole lot of help from them in understanding what was going on.
No, that's true. There are many things talked about today that weren't even breathed back then.
Yeah, they really were. So it was a pretty stressful experience for me, I have to admit.
Well, but it sounds like your friend Mitch and just the World Series, it sounds like you had some experiences there that began to help bridge the cavern.
Yeah, Mitch, it was funny. Mitch and I both moved out of Cincinnati after that year, and I really didn't have any contact with him after then.
Oh, really?
We just kept up, yeah. I was there for 1 year exactly, and he moved again a couple of months after I left. So we just, you know, we lost contact, and I don't know. I think his family went back to Brooklyn, but I don't know what's become of him. But it was a very important friendship for me at that time, and I've always been grateful for it.
Of course it was, and I'm curious, in writing this book, has there been an opportunity for you to reconnect with him after all these years?
I've done some internet searching and haven't found anything. Of course, I mean, he could have died years ago. I really don't know.
Right.
No, I haven't gotten back into touch with him.
Now that would be an interesting experience, wouldn't it?
It would be, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hope something comes of that. Well, Albert, let's talk just a little bit about the different genre styles. You've written several. How does writing a memoir differ from writing a novel?
Well, writers are always told to bleed onto the page, and we do that in varying degrees, I guess. When you're writing fiction, every character has something of you in them, but the reader never knows, you know, is this the author or not.
Right.
But when I'm putting myself as a character into this memoir, then clearly it's all me. And I did have to think about some things I wanted to put in. I mean, I had a nickname when I was 11 years old, and I hated it. And moving from South Carolina to Cincinnati, where nobody knew me, gave me a chance to shed that nickname.
Uh-huh.
And my writers group said, you know, you're going to have to put the nickname in the book.
Oh.
And I said, you don't know how difficult that's going to be after hiding this for 50 years. But I did, and, you know, it didn't turn out to be all that embarrassing.
Was it a cathartic experience?
In some ways, yeah, I think so.
Good.
You know, you're sort of hiding something or afraid of something for a long time, but then once it's out there, well, there's nothing to hide anymore.
Well, and it's in even more than just hiding. It's almost like, you know, you can associate bad experiences with that nickname,
yeah,
or that other name, and the fact that you've had an opportunity to change it sort of begins to give you a chance to have some control over changing the destiny, the course of your destiny, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
Good, good.
But I also found it useful, you know, the fact that I have written fiction. What I've put in the book is true. I haven't created anything that didn't happen. But nobody remembers exactly what happened 50 years ago or exactly everything that was said in every situation. So it is useful as a fiction writer to know how to craft a scene and to be able to construct dialogue, if you can't remember what was said, to be able to create enough dialogue that it gets the point across to the reader.
Well, exactly. Capture the essence.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's great. Well, Albert, we are just about out of time here, and as we're wrapping things up, would you let the audience know where they can purchase your book?
It's available through any book dealer. Any bookstore can order it, or you can get to Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. Or you can go to my website, which is www.albertbell.com, and it's Bell, just B-E-L-L, albertbell.com. And if you click on the nonfiction category, you can read a couple of chapters of the book, and you can see a link where you can buy an autographed copy from my publisher.
And that's right, you said autographed copy, right?
Autographed copy.
Good, 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 good. Well, Albert, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. Your book is a great read, even for non-sports enthusiasts. And I want to encourage everyone out there to go to your website, as well as to InsideScoopLive.com and ReaderViews.com to look over the reviews. Also, this internet radio segment will be posted to all of those websites. So I want to encourage everyone out there to take a look and a listen and consider purchasing this book for your own library or as a gift. Albert, thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure, Gail. Thank you.
And audience, thank you for tuning in to this segment of Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Until the next time, bye.